It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good to have you back.
Thank you. I was laid up last week, but I'm doing better now.
All right. Visiting our fine, one of our fine healthcare institutions.
Absolutely. And they made me much sicker than I was when I went in. So.
Yeah, that's good. It's important that you take away something.
Yes, and I did.
All right. Well,
actually, I purged a few things, too, but let's not get into that.
No, we're not going to get into that. Looks like the NRA has a new poster child.
Yes, they do. Well, you know, shooting birds, shooting hunting companions, shooting Arabs. It's all kind of the same thing. Now, tell me, have you ever shot a friend?
No, I can safely say, to the best of my recollection, I've never shot a friend.
It seems to me that if you had shot a friend and he seemed to be seriously wounded, and if this guy had a shotgun pellet lodged in his heart, it seems to me that he's likely to be seriously wounded and probably shot from a distance quite a bit closer than 30 yards also. But it seems to me that if you were concerned about this person's welfare, you would go to the hospital with him, wouldn't you?
Well, I would. But...
And particularly if you had an entourage so that you could get there even if you were too drunk to drive.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What's your point?
Well, that Cheney didn't do that. He went back to the ranch and had a nice meal.
I hope it wasn't quail.
I mean, this guy is a creep. I mean, there's really no way to put a spin on it. And then he goes on to Fox News with his softball questions this week from Britt Hume and talks about it being the worst day of his life. Now, this is a guy who is pretty much the architect of an illegal invasion of a sovereign nation that had never done anything to attack the United States. And that invasion has led to a war in which well over 100,000 civilians have died that would not have otherwise died. So this guy's got an enormous amount of blood on his hands. And the worst day of his life is when he injures somebody that he happens to know. I mean, this is almost a textbook definition of a sociopath, somebody who is unable to understand the consequences of his actions in society. It's really, really frightening, not so much because he shot a guy, although, you know, there one would think there should be consequences for that, as to what his reaction tells us about this guy's mindset. I mean, let alone the fact that he didn't report it and he's probably lying about a number of the circumstances of it that just don't add up, like the distance between him and Whittington and how it is if the guy's down in the gully and only the upper half of his body is visible and he's shooting at a bird that was flushed from the brush. You know, birds are supposed to be flying. They're supposed to be up in the air. They're not supposed to be right at ground level. I mean, there's just several things that don't make sense. But, you know, quite aside from that, I mean, his reaction to the whole thing is just chilling. You know, it's really much ado about nothing in a lot of ways. I mean, there's an awful lot of things that this White House and that this vice president have done which are far more insidious than this. You know, Iraq being the obvious example, but there's tons of others. And there's plenty of things that happened this week, many of which we'll talk about in the next half hour, that were more important than this. But it really is quite an insight into the mindset of the vice president of the United States, and it's a real unfortunate one.
Yeah, and it's if, as you could see on the excerpts that are on the blog, your ETS blog, that someone put up there of the the press conferences that have been held.
Yes, that was Eddie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
Very intriguing reading there. So.
Yeah, Eddie Tews put up transcripts of the reporters questioning Scott McClellan, and the reporters are just much, much more aggressive than they've been about things like NSA spying or Plamegate or, you know, any of the other allegedly illegal actions of the White House. You know, the White House press corps lobs softball questions for that, but cut them out of a loop for 20 hours and they get really angry, and it's really funny to read. It just goes on and on and on. So check that out at the Eat the State blog.
All right. Well, you mentioned spying, and there's some updates this week on the situation with the NSA spying.
Yeah, the biggest and most unfortunate is that the Senate Judiciary Committee, headed by Pennsylvania's Arlen Specter, is basically backing off of its probe of the NSA spying. It can't get the documents that they want from the White House. The White House is stonewalling them, and so they're just shrugging their shoulders and going home, this being the Republicans on the committee. The Democrats are angry about it, of course, but there's really nothing they can do. And so we're not going to find out a number of critical things about White House documents pertaining to this program. Or we might, because a federal judge this week in Washington, D.C., ordered the release of the documents that have been withheld in response to a lawsuit filed by the ACLU and some other nonprofits. One of the thoughts as to what is in those documents and the particular documents that the groups were seeking was the legal opinions within the White House as to whether this program was in fact legal or not. Now, remember that it was suspended for several months at one point, I think in 2003, because of concerns about legality, and then it was started up again. So the thought is that one of the reasons the White House doesn't want to release these documents, other than its knee-jerk tendency towards secrecy, is that the documents say that there are people even within the White House who thought this program was illegal, told the president it was illegal, and the president went ahead with it anyway, which would be as compelling a reason for impeachment as any. The question is, how can we get those documents? Obviously, the White House is going to appeal this court decision, but they were told within 20 days to either release the documents or provide a list of documents that were being withheld, and presumably it'll go from there. I'm really can't imagine what will get these documents out of the White House if they're as explosive as some people think they might be. They will probably risk contempt of court rather than trying to get them up, and you could see it turn into a constitutional crisis. But keep an eye on that.
Yeah, it seems like the only things that come out are when things are purposely leaked.
Yes, or when they've been doctored and or they're flat misinformation.
All right. Jumping over to international, let's talk about there's been a lot of developments with the situation in Iran.
Yeah, that really got onto the front burner this week, of course, for a number of months now, really well over a year. The White House has been very quietly laying the plans to try and diplomatically isolate Iran, make the case internationally, which it really has not done so far, that Iran is trying to illegally develop a nuclear weapons program, and basically lay the groundwork for some sort of military strike against Iran, probably a strike directly at the 40 or so sites that have been identified as possibly being attached to a nuclear weapons program. And of course, Israel is very much itching to do this also, but really nobody else in the world is. The danger of this, of course, is that Iran would almost certainly retaliate if there were any kind of a military strike on it. They share borders with Afghanistan and Iraq. The country of Iraq right now is controlled by the Shiites, pro-Iranian forces. Iran is in a very good position to exact retribution of the United States. They could make United States military forces in those two countries very, very uncomfortable. They also have ties to some terrorist groups, not just Hamas and Hezbollah, but other groups around the world that could target American facilities. So the real danger is that if this military strike is carried out, it could lead to a much wider war involving Afghanistan, involving Iraq, involving Israel, and quite possibly the whole Middle East and even beyond. This is the kind of a war that the White House is very gradually and inexorably leading us toward. Even potentially that sort of strike could happen as soon as next month. A number of reports have come out, including one from Russian intelligence, saying next month, saying March 28th, etc. And there's a couple of key dates next month. On March 6th, the International Atomic Energy Agency, at the request of the United States, is once again considering whether to refer Iran to the United Nations Security Council for having not cooperated on various requests having to do with its alleged weapons program. Now, the problem is that the United States in all this time has not really produced any evidence whatsoever that Iran is actually developing nuclear weapons. There is no such evidence. Iran says that all it's developing is a nuclear energy program, which it's perfectly entitled to do. Russia agrees. China agrees. Russia has already said that they would not support any move toward a military strike. China this week actually signed a $100 billion oil agreement with Iran, so you know that those two countries are not going to let anything pass the Security Council. But the idea is that even referring it to the Security Council would give legitimacy to the United States' claims that, that it doesn't really have right now. So the United States is pressuring countries like India quite a bit to go along with it with the IAEA request. Also, next month, Iran is planning to convert its oil sales from dollars into euros. Now, this doesn't sound like that big a deal. Iran is only the fourth or fifth largest oil exporter in the world. But beyond that, it sets a huge precedent. Unlike a few years ago when Saddam threatened to do the same thing, the United States now has an enormous public debt, mostly to countries like China and Japan, which incidentally are also not about to fund a new war, which they would pretty much have to do because the United States can't afford it otherwise. But we have an enormous public debt, we have an enormous trade deficit, and there's really nothing supporting the dollar right now. So if there's a run on the dollar and a shift in international currency exchange and oil sales toward the euro, it could have a devastating effect on the United States economy. So the thought is that the White House would like to try very hard in one way or another to try and prevent this from happening. This kind of information really needs to get out to the public. We had some additional developments this week. The White House sent a request to Congress for $75 million for a new propaganda campaign aimed at Iran. That includes funding for pro-democracy groups within the country. Now, of course, there's already a huge pro-democracy movement within Iran that has captured elected offices as high as the presidency in the past before the Bush saber-rattling pushed the domestic political power within Iran toward the hardline clerics in the past couple of years. But the United States, as usual, as with Iraq, they don't want to work with any of the existing pro-democracy people. They want to form their own groups that they can control and trot out as appropriate. That obviously wouldn't have any legitimacy within Iran itself. The other thing that's happening is Condoleezza Rice is taking a trip next week to Egypt and I believe Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates as part of to kick off a campaign to try and drum up international support for a U.S. confrontation with Iran. So this stuff is moving along, and the only way that I can really see to prevent it is if there is domestic political opposition within the United States, because if there is within an election year, drawing on the experience of Iraq, where we know that they lied to us in the run-up to the war. We know that the war itself has been a disaster. We know that most people within the United States both believe both of those things and want to pull out. They're tired of the war in Iraq. We have to make the case that the war in Iran would be disastrous, that there's a high chance that it would spread into a regional conflict that would prompt more terror, that it would endanger the United States economy and decimate its military, and an awful lot of people would die on all sides than have died so far in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have to make the case that that's a much higher risk than trying diplomacy, as was done with Libya. And in this case, it's not an existing nuclear weapons program. It's one that's probably close to a decade away from being functional, even if it exists, which we do not know. So that case has to be publicized and it has to be made. And activists have to start thinking about that right now before we get sucked into another very, very dangerous war.
All right. Well, speaking of dangerous wars, more developments, as there are every week, in Iraq.
Yeah, the White House requested another $65 billion in supplemental money to the 2006 budget. Of course, the White House doesn't actually include the cost of the war in Iraq within its budgets. It just goes hat in hand to Congress every time it needs a few tens of millions more dollars for Iraq. At the same time, over in Iraq itself, we had more Abu Ghraib photos being released, and that that hasn't really gotten very much attention in the United States. But particularly coming on top of the cartoon controversy, it's really stoked anti-Americanism within Iraq itself. There have been demonstrations even in Kurdish Iraq, which is the by far the most pro-American of the regions within Iraq. You know, we're really wearing out our welcome there. At the same time, there have been enormous demonstrations against the British in southern Iraq, where they've had control of Basra and other regions, because of the release of photos and footage showing British beating Iraqi prisoners, British soldiers beating Iraqi prisoners, to the point where the local Iraqi councils are refusing to cooperate, have anything to do, even communicate with the occupying British forces. They're really making the British presence in southern Iraq untenable. Now, of course, over the past couple of years, the control of the radical Shiite clerics in southern Iraq has hardened to such an extent that that entire part of the country is now pretty much controlled by Sharia law. Women have to be veiled in public. We've seen all kinds of movement backwards in terms of human rights there. It's very much a snapshot of what the entire country would look like under the Shiite government that has just been formed. And it looks very similar to Iran, frankly. This is the kind of democracy that the George Bush is talking about when he talks about how freedom is on the march in Iraq, and it's just not true. And we're seeing more and more antipathy among ordinary Iraqis toward their occupiers, both British and American, and more pressure from the Iraqi government probably for the occupying forces to leave, even as Americans keep working on constructing and expanding a number of permanent military bases in Iraq. So something's going to have to give somewhere pretty soon. We also, incidentally, had some interesting testimony from Condoleezza Rice to a Senate committee in which she acknowledged pretty much for the first time that both oil production and the generation of electricity were well below pre-war levels, that the United States has utterly failed to do anything to help the Iraqi economy during its years of occupation and then after its installed government there. So that was interesting because the White House really has not admitted that before. Of course, she really couldn't help but admit it. She first tried not to, and then there was a fairly sharp questioning from Senator Durgin of North Dakota that brought that out. You know, clearly, despite their public pronouncements, the White House is well aware of what's going on in Iraq. They just don't want to fess up to it.
Well, if I could, you mentioned the recent, just out this week, the Abu Ghraib photos and video that just came out.
Sure.
Having an interview tomorrow morning from 7 to 8 with Pratap Chatterjee, who is with Corp Watch. And,
yes, he's very, very good.
Yeah, and he has brought out for quite a while about the information that the interrogators and translators that are in these facilities are actually from private companies that are brought in and basically, you know, kind of guns for hire.
And not very well trained either.
Yeah, most of them aren't very well trained at all. So that'll be from 7 to 8 tomorrow morning. So moving along, the UN had some a report out and some strong words about the Guantanamo situation.
Yeah, a report from the United Nations Human Rights Commission this week that did not get that much attention in United States media, but once again, it was big news in the rest of the world and underscores just how badly the United States' moral standing in the rest of the world has been damaged by how the Bush administration has prosecuted the war on terror. In this case, the United Nations is demanding, and Kofi Annan backed this up, is demanding that the United Nations shut down the Guantanamo Bay facility. They're saying that torture is still being practiced there. They gave a number of examples of how torture is being practiced there. They were not allowed by the United States to come in and actually interview the prisoners, but they interviewed a number of ex-prisoners and their lawyers and a number of human rights groups and advocates like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and the International Red Cross that have been monitoring the situation there. And they just blasted the United States. The report says that the use of excessive force during transportation, force feeding through nasal tubes during hunger strikes, and shackling, chaining, and hooding of prisoners, placing them in solitary confinement, subjecting them naked to severe temperatures, and threatening them with dogs, all of that amounts to torture, and it does under international law, even though it's something many of these things are practices that are also routinely practiced in control units and other jails within the United States for many years. And, of course, human rights groups have long condemned that as well. But this is a really high-profile thing, and it, as I say, it really underscores how bad Guantanamo Bay is, and that many of the 490 prisoners there, of course, the White House immediately dismissed this report and says, well, remember, these are terrorists. Well, we don't know that. Most all of the prisoners there are 490 of them now, have never had due process, have never had any kind of trial. The United States has never produced any evidence that these people are terrorists, and in many cases, they're not. In many cases, they're innocent. There are simply people who are in the wrong place at the wrong time, mostly in Afghanistan. And they've been, you know, dropped into indefinite detention for the rest of their lives without access to due process, without protection by the Geneva Conventions or other prisoners of war standards. It's an absolutely indefensible situation, and there really needs to be more domestic pressure to back up the international demands that Guantanamo Bay be closed.
All right. Well, jumping back.
Oh, I had one other Guantanamo issue, which was there was a Christian group, mostly Catholic peace activists, who went to Guantanamo in December and did a peace walk about 60 miles through Cuba to the gates of Guantanamo, and then demanded that they be allowed into the base and meet with the prisoners and with base officials. They sat around at the gates for several days while this was debated, and then they were finally denied, and they went home. Well, seven of these activists this week were notified by the Treasury Department that they were in violation of the travel embargo to Cuba, an embargo that tens of thousands of Americans violate every year with impunity. But apparently, this was a little bit too high profile of a violation for the Treasury Department's comfort, and that they're subject to possibly 10 years in prison, additional fines, and the Treasury Department, of course, wants all the information on who was involved with the trip and all the rest of that. So we have activists now who went to Guantanamo, who witnessed some of the intransigence there and lack of transparency, who are now being prosecuted by the United States government for having the temerity to want to see how their tax dollars are being spent. So keep an eye on that one.
All right. Well, jumping back to this state, Washington, it looks like there was a poll that came out this week and didn't show Christine Gregoire in a very favorable light.
Yeah, there were actually a number of interesting results to the poll. I have it up at the Eat the State blog, www.feedthefish.org/ETSblog. But probably the most interesting one was the status of Christine Gregoire and the fallout from the 2004 election. Gregoire had only a 38% job approval rating compared to a 54% disapproval rating, even though she's really had an enormous amount of legislative success in the last 1.5 legislative sessions. She's gotten far more done in that period of time than Gary Locke got done in 8 years. But the 54% disapproval is quite a bit higher than the percentage of Republicans in the state, so it suggests that a number of independents and even some Democrats also disapprove of Gregoire. Even more telling is that the proposed matchup with Dino Rossi in 2008, if there were to be a rematch of the 2004 race, 35% would vote for Gregoire right now. 55% would vote for Dino Rossi, who has really said and done nothing since that 2004 race. Even more telling than that, when asked whether people thought that the electoral problems in 2004, which were primarily King County, had been fixed, 16% said yes, 71% said no. Now, the electoral problems didn't have to do with touchscreen voting or anything like that. What they had to do with was, at least in the public's mind, was the Republican allegations that the Gregoire won the election through fraud, that the King County election officials intentionally stuffed the ballots, essentially, so that Gregoire could win. Now, this was a case that was quite literally laughed out of court when the Republicans brought their lawsuit in Chelan County. You know, they picked their own court, they picked their own judge, and the judge just blistered them, said in so many words that their allegations were preposterous, and they were. There wasn't any real evidence to support it whatsoever. But the problem was the Republicans made these allegations in public through a credulous statewide media for month after month after month after month throughout 2005 until the lawsuit was settled. And still, you know, a number of months later, 7, 8, 9 months after that, we see that that campaign, that media campaign by the Republicans, has had an enormous impact on Gregoire's governorship. A lot of people still have stuck in their mind that Gregoire should not be governor, that the election was stolen from Dino Rossi, that Rossi should be the rightful governor, blah, blah, and that the election problems were problems with King County and the Democrats stuffing the ballot. Somehow, that perception really took hold among the public in Washington State, and the Democrats and new Democratic State Chair Dwight Pelz cannot ignore that. They have to do something, not only to demonstrate that the Democratic control of the governorship and the state legislature is a beneficial thing for Washington, but they have to go back and make the case that Gregoire is the rightful governor. They have to keep hammering away at that, or that damage is never going to be fixed, and Gregoire and the Democrats are going to be in big trouble in 2008.
Moving along, there has been a response to a grassroots response to Tim Eymann's initiative that...
Yeah, there was an announcement this week that a new statewide coalition of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender advocates and their supporters have pulled together in a new coalition, optimistically entitled Washington Won't Discriminate. They have a new website up, washingtonwon'tdiscriminate.org, all one word with no apostrophe in the won't. WashingtonWon'tDiscriminate.org, and you can sign up there either to get email updates or to volunteer or to donate. This is going to be a very difficult campaign. Most such initiatives and referendum in other states over the years have been successful. We saw how many states rejected gay marriage, for example, in 2004. So this is going to be a really uphill battle. People need to start organizing around it right now. WashingtonWon'tDiscriminate.org. Please support them.
Well, and speaking of uphill battles, Booth Gardner is going to be pushing an initiative.
Yeah, the former governor from for 2 terms, 85 to 93, is now nearly 70 years old. He has Parkinson's disease, and for his political swan song, he has announced that in 2008 he's going to push an initiative for right to die legislation, very similar to what Oregon passed and was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court last year. So look for that as well. That's something that, as somebody with chronic health problems myself, I really very, very strongly support, and a lot of people with health problems or who have been through life-threatening illness feel the same way.
Okay, I just got time for one more thing. Occidental Park, looking like...
Yeah, the Parks Department, in yet another one of its top-down decisions for which the public wasn't really consulted, is cutting down all the trees in Occidental Park starting this weekend. Nick Licata, councilperson, is trying to prevent it. He's asked Parks Director Ken Bounds to stop the tree cutting while a lawsuit is heard that alleges that the city hasn't done any kind of... The Parks Department hasn't done any kind of environmental impact statement on this. What the Parks Department wants to do, basically, is pave Occidental Park, get rid of all the trees because of the nasty shadows that they cast, and make it a place that would be, you know, less amenable to the homeless, basically. Now, this is just one of many controversies that the Parks Department has gotten into in recent months, and they all pretty much look the same. They look like the Parks Department is a very top-down bureaucracy that is not involving the public, that is not notifying the public when it makes major decisions. We saw this with the Gasworks Park one real real concerts, summer concerts thing that was talked about at 7:30. We saw this with the daylighting of Ravenna Creek. We saw it with the skateboard park being sited near Woodland Park Zoo. There's just a whole list of them that have happened in recent months, and it really points up a serious problem with the Parks Department and in the city of Seattle. Bounds is a very close ally of Mayor Greg Nickels. There's a proposal out, in fact, to make the leadership of the Parks Department become an elected office, because that's, some neighborhood activists feel like that's the only way that somebody like Bounds can be gotten out of office when they're close to the mayor, as Bounds is to Nickels.
All right. Real quick, got an email in from listener Jeff Moore. In regards to the White House refusing to release documents related to the outing of Valerie Plame, Jobs says there is nothing much the Democrats can do. There's plenty a real opposition party can do, up to and including helping to organize protests against tyranny. A little imagination can reveal lots the Dems could do. So...
yeah, I was thinking more of congressional procedure, but he's absolutely right. And it's not even so much what Democrats can do, it's what the general public can do to make this more of an issue. And we should.
Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor to Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a community newspaper that comes out every couple of weeks. It's absolutely free of charge. You can find it in bookstores and libraries. It's distributed in the King County Library System, cafes, anywhere you find pre-publications, it's there. It's also on the web, not only the current issue, but all of our back issues going back 10 years. This year is our 10th year anniversary, by the way. We'll talk more about that later this year. www.eatthestate.org, and there's a link there to our blog as well. If you have comments, tips, you'd like to donate, you'd like to volunteer, because we're all pretty much volunteers at Eat the State, help write, help distribute, help edit, help sell ads, whatever it is you might want to do, we can always use the help. Give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947, or write us at info@eatthestate.org.